Bob McClendon with the Good Old Gamers here. I'm here with Brandon Gentry, as always. And we are sitting here with Mr. Richard Moss of Pints and Pixels.
Hey, guys.
Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Yeah, appreciate it.
No problem.
It's a pretty sweet setup you got going on in here.
Thank you.
It's amazing.
We just had to stand in here and with our jaws on the ground for a second and kind of take it all in.
It's, I have to say, if the old saying is, if I do say so myself, I enjoy just being up here. It's only really come together in the last couple of weeks or so, since we got like all the games up here and plugged in and all the artwork, finished and all the tables and everything in place. And it just started to really come together probably a couple of weeks ago. And, just having the, music videos playing and having the games turned on and stuff, it's just, I don't know how everyone else. I mean, so far it seems to be positively received by, but of course it's mostly friends and family that have come in so far.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Interested to see what the public thinks. But personally, I'm pleased with what we've been able to build.
We got listeners all over the place. We even got some in Germany. So I guess we should probably explain what Pints and Pixels is for everyone who's not in the know.
It's Huntsville, Alabama. If you're familiar with that, we got listeners up there, hopefully. But it's here.
Tell you want me to talk about it?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
Yeah, we're in downtown Huntsville. There's the new sort of what they're calling the Mercantile Building. I used to call it the Mason Building, but they've got this big neon sign out there now from UG White Mercantile that moved in. They bought the building and opened a second location here, and then we're leasing this top floor from them. But it's a restaurant, bar, arcade. We try to stay away from using the term barcade just because that's technically a trademarked word. So we don't advertise using that word,
okay.
but people do know that term. It's becoming somewhat common. So, but anyway, so we don't ever officially use that. But I mean, at the same time, if you'd say to someone that that's what we are, they'll know what you mean, right?
So, yeah.
We have vintage. We're pretty much totally vintage on the video games. We've got about 40 or so. I'm not sure what the latest count actually is, but I'm pretty sure it's right around 40 video games, ranging from probably 79 or 80 to, meaning 1979 or 80 to like maybe 92 or 93 for the newest game here.
Nice.
And then really the funny thing is on the pinball side of it, we almost kind of pick up where the video games stop. So we really go from more of the early 90s up through modern.
Yeah, 90s had a pretty big pinball resurgence.
Yes, basically, the most collectible games in pinball are from that period.
A lot of movie pinball machines from that time.
Yeah. The most, anyone that's in the pinball, knows this, but, the Addams Family. That's the most, probably the best-selling pinball of all time. And that was in 90, I think, maybe 5 or something like that. Great game, fantastic game. And there were a lot of games. So many good ones from that era, and so that's where I decided to really focus the pinball part of this. And the thing is, even if you get a new pinball game, like they just announced Ghostbusters, from Stern.
I've already been.
That's going to be a huge seller, by the way. I'm telling you right now, in terms of, I really believe in terms of things made since like 2000, that's probably going to be the new best-selling pinball game. Now, nothing is going to touch Addams Family or the stuff from the 90s, probably.
Yeah.
But we are on a bit of a resurgence again now, and which is great. And, that game is going to – I think it's going to be huge. But, it has to play well. We'll see. We don't know that yet. But it looks phenomenal. And, it's a wonderful license. I think it's really well-suited for a pinball game. We're going to get one too, by the way. But anyways, my point on all that is you get a brand-new pinball game. Yeah, it's brand-new, but you know what? It's also still pinball. It's still two flippers and trying to keep a ball alive and trying to get multi-ball and, trying to hit ramps and pop bumpers and, drop targets. And, it's still, they've really not, a pinball today, go back to like, the early 80s, even comparing to the early 80s games, there's a difference in the way pins look from then to now, but nothing like the difference that you would see in a video game from then to now.
Yeah.
They're completely unrecognizable as being the same thing almost. So, But with pinball, there's not that many that great of a lead. So it still feels retro, even though it's a modern game.
I know of one pinball machine I saw the Southern Fried Game Room Expo we went to last year. They had it was mostly an LCD board with a touch sensor for the ball. It had a few bumpers, and it was really cool because you could change the whole theme of the machine anytime you wanted. But at the same time, it was missing the things that made it a pinball machine. Mm. So
that's the multimorphic. Is that what they have some neat tech. I think it's still only about two thirds baked, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. They're trying to walk, I think they have to walk a really fine line with what they're trying to do, because they're trying to really innovate, and I applaud them for it. But at the same time, most pinheads aren't really looking for huge innovation because they just like pinball the way it is.
Yeah.
So you've got to, and you need that crowd to sell anything. So, you know, how you've got to be innovative and yet still nostalgic enough, or still, you know, have enough of a classic pinball feel to keep that crowd interested. So it's going to be tough for them, but I hope they can be successful because I think they have some really interesting ideas. And I would like to see some new wrinkles get introduced into pinball, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how they do.
I think it's definitely going to make a pretty big comeback. Last year, like he said, we went to Southern Fried in Atlanta. And you could definitely tell the big distinctions between the pinball players and the video gamers.
Yeah.
You know?
Almost a pinball, soft rivalry between the two of them.
I mean, I don't feel like there should be, but, sometimes it just gets that way. They're having tournaments there too, so you gotta remember, like, a chunk of the pinball, not, I don't know what percentage, but I mean, they're having like a legit tournament with, you know, points for national rankings and all this kind of stuff going on, right? So there's players there who are there to compete. And you know, they couldn't care at all about the video games. That they're there to play not just pinball, but those specific like 10 pinball games. So
Go ahead.
I enjoy them both, but I am quite miserable at pinball.
I'm terrible at it.
I'm actually no good either. I really am not. But you know, that's the great thing about it, though. I mean, it's just like bowling.
Learning curve.
You can be really good and throw a mean hook, and you know, average, you know, 225 or something, or you can just be a hacker and go throw it down the middle, and you know, be happy if you get to like 100. And you can, either way, you can still have a blast with your with your buddies. You know, you can just go out there and drink a couple of beers and throw some balls and just have fun.
Yeah.
And it's the same with pinball. I mean, you can be someone who's awesome and tries to get to the wizard mode on all the games and set high scores and, you know, compete in tournaments. Or you can just go and just play and just, you know, enjoy it. Just be glad if you can get, like, one multi-ball going, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, pinball is how possibly one of the most famous video game players got started, Billy Mitchell. He said that was his start, was pinball.
Oh.
He said he hated, like, the video games. Like, Pac-Man was just the machine that was in his way. Yeah. Until finally he got on it, and, you know, he just dropped it.
I actually didn't know that about him.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
We actually did a small talk with him last year as well.
Okay. Oh, cool.
It was he's not what you would think he is.
No.
We'll say that.
Well, and it's kind of deal. Billy Mitchell has a sort of movie persona online persona.
I've compared him mostly to a professional wrestler.
He knows how to play a heel.
Yep.
And but if I've heard from multiple people that he's a very different person, he can actually be a really nice guy. And I got to see a little bit of that too. I was at the, not last year's Southern Fry, but the first one before.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And he was there and doing some he had a thing where you could go play Pac-Man against him, you know, and some other things that he did. And he just seemed very, you know, personable. He talked to a lot of the show attendees, you know, and just signed things. And
I never saw him once say no to a picture or an autograph.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though he still carried that persona with him, he wasn't just going to tell you to bugger off.
Yeah, yeah, no. No, I mean, he just... And the thing is, I mean, he got that. I don't know. I don't know him really, and I certainly didn't know anything about him before, you know, seeing King of Kong. But I almost gather, you know, the thing about King of Kong is, you know, there were certain elements of that were not entirely truthful.
Yeah, the way the editing was done, very misleading.
I don't know how much of that he knew about beforehand. Maybe none. or maybe a lot. I'm not sure. But, you know, you could almost imagine if he basically said, yeah, I'll be a bad guy here.
I can make a buck off.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. I don't know anything. I don't have any reason to necessarily think that he did do that, but it wouldn't surprise me. But or it just happened and he just embraced it. You know, it just came out that way and he said, okay, whatever. That's fine. I'll be a bad guy. And it worked.
Yeah.
One thing about Pints and Pixels, I was going to ask, do you feel extreme pressure opening an arcade in a time where there's an arcade drought? You know what I mean?
I feel the pressure more from just the difficulties of running a bar and restaurant than I do the arcade, really. There's definitely plenty of pressure to go around, however you want to find it. I wouldn't look at it so much as a arcade sort of desert. I mean, to some degree that might be true, but I mean, if you're the only guy in the desert selling water, you're going to do well, right?
Yes, very true.
But it's mainly, do you have enough people to sell the water too? And because there's been a lot of these arcade bars that have popped up over the last dozen years. You know, it started in Portland with Ground Control, and then pretty soon after that, Barcade in Brooklyn. And then, there's been other ones that have popped up in between across the country, and now every major city has at least one, and usually now two or three or four. I mean, Chicago has maybe four or five now, I think. And they've almost all either are just doing well as their own location, or they've done well enough that they've gone and expanded into adjacent space and then added food. Like maybe they started off just bar and games and then they later added food. Or they added a second location, in some cases a third location. So the concept overall, and I mean this isn't one big chain. These are all just independent operators.
Yeah.
They can't all be exceptional managers of restaurants and bars, right?
Yeah.
If they're all doing well, and statistically, some of them are probably just mediocre or even bad, but they're still in business, then there's something about the concept itself that's working. So I felt very good about the concept, especially after I went to a few places and got a better understanding of what it really was and, who the audience for it was and so forth. But we're still probably going to be one of the smallest cities in the country with this type of concept in it. So that's where there's a test, more than anything else. And by the way, I should say there have been a couple of them that I have heard about that have failed, have closed. But I mean, it's 2 out of 20 or something, which compared to the normal restaurant or bar averages is flipped. It's right. So, so I think that's a really good number. But again, they're almost all in much larger cities. So I did take one trip to Boise, Idaho, for the first Grinker's. I can't remember what they call that thing now, but it was basically a meetup of the Arcade Outsiders podcasters. They're one's in Boston, one's in somewhere in Minnesota, and the other one's in San Diego, and they all met up at this place in Boise, Idaho. And all of these guys are on KLOV. I say KLOV, but some people say KLOV. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
And so this guy, Steve, he goes by Idaho Farmer on there and, has this place, Grinker's in Boise, or Eagle, Idaho, actually, which is kind of like their Boise's Madison, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Their metro area is not that much larger than Huntsville's. It's at most maybe 25% larger or something like that. So I went to that, and I sent him a message and said, hey, if I come up there, if I fly up there and come to this thing, could you sit down and chat with me a little bit about your business? Because I'm thinking about doing something similar. And he said, yeah, come on up. We'll talk shop. So I did. And I sat down and talked to him for probably an hour and a half. And he shared all kinds of information, numbers-wise and everything, and how he went about hiring people and, what he paid in utilities and just all kinds of stuff. And, they weren't really to a point of being profitable quite yet at that time. That was 2 years ago. I assume they're still open. So, and they were growing at the time. So I suspect now they're probably doing great. He said they were ahead of their projection, their initial 3-year plan. So That was encouraging, and I also felt, and not to disparage this place because I think it's fantastic. It's just slightly different than what I wanted to do in the sense of the balance of what's there. So his place on the video game side is amazing. It has like over 100. I think it's like 140 games or something. It's wow. Like three times or whatever that we're going to have. So wonderful arcade, all kinds of obscure titles, rare stuff, you know, that you can't really play anywhere else almost, or, you know, maybe two or three places across the whole country that have, you know, a certain game that he has on the floor. So love it. But a small food menu and a very small bar menu, just a handful of beers and no spirits or anything, just beer. So I felt like, you know, if he's doing okay with that, I think if he had had more, you know, and his food was cold subs, basically, you know, their own menu, not, I mean, better than Subway, but
yeah,
but still, it's just cold. It's cold food. It's, you know, so I mean, on a Friday night, you know, usually you're not really, and you're out with friends drinking beer and playing games. You're really probably not wanting a cold sub.
And you want something crazy awesome.
Right. Some bar food. So I think he could probably have make more money. But he, you know, his place is what he wants it to be. So I'm not at all. I just feel like, though, that in terms of being successful financially, I think with the mix that we're going to have here, I think we'll have an even better shot. So, and I'll tell you the response so far, just organically from you know, on social media primarily, has been really, really strong. We get messages every day about if we're open or when we're going to open or what the hours are.
I know there's quite a few member of people from Coleman who's looking forward to coming up.
Yeah, we've made a post Coleman, really. Coming up here, and we had a bunch of people that were
talking awesome.
About how excited they were, and a
cool.
couple that thought it was already open.
Yeah,
and
we've had some just walk in because, you know, if we don't lock out the elevator, sometimes people just see the sign and go, oh, it's, you know, it must be open, and they just go in. And I hate to have to tell them, like, no, sorry, you know, but you can look around for a minute if you want, you know. But so there's people are, there seems to be some pent up demand for it to open, and for us, I just hope that. And this is where I feel the most pressure, honestly, is that when that initial rush happens, and I think that's probably what's going to happen, is there going to be like this big rush at the beginning, that we have our A game, or at least our B game, you know, enough in terms of getting food out, getting it, you know, out hot and cooked right, you know, because the food part of this has the most moving parts to it, in a way, you know.
Yeah. The machines are going to be there doing their thing unless they break.
Yeah,
it's got to be made.
And I mean, you know, pouring beers is pretty straightforward. I mean, we've got a good tap system in place, and I feel like we're going to be okay there. I'm sure some of our mixed drinks might be a little slow at first, but you know, this town is all right now all about craft beer.
Yeah,
that's one thing we were going to ask about. Me and Brandon like our beer, and we assume we're all going to have a very rather impressive.
Well, you know. It's
like
one of those things.
The local scene, kind of.
Compared to 10 years ago, what we're going to have would probably have been called very impressive. You know, nowadays, everyone's craft beer game has gone up so many steps that, you know, I think we're just trying to kind of be level with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, which is a great situation to be in for the city, though. I love it. I mean, you can go so many places and get, you know, 20 or 30, you know, taps of mostly craft beer, and a lot of locals, a lot of regionals, and the brewing scene here has blown up in the last decade. I mean, just absolutely exploded. And it's all the way from Birmingham, you know, to Huntsville, to Madison.
I don't know. I can't hardly walk into a convenience store without seeing, like, straight to L or something.
Yeah.
Like
I mean, even at the BP or whatever, you're still going to see that stuff. I mean, so we would definitely want to support that and, you know, sell that along with some national stuff, too. But we're going to have a heavy emphasis on locals, you know, for sure.
That's awesome.
But anyway, yeah, the kitchen, I just feel like, you know, we're going to have a couple days of training and then we're going to be open. And, you know, so at first we may have some slow, you know, orders, you know, ticket times maybe a little long and while we kind of get things figured out. But if people will be a little patient on that side with us, you know, I think it'll be good to end. I mean, Anaheim Chili, have you guys ever been there?
I haven't.
Okay. Well, it's on Cecil Ashburn Road in Huntsville, and that's southeast Huntsville, you know, Bailey Cove sort of area down there. Close to that, there's a Target shopping center real close down there, and like a Carmike movie theater.
Yeah.
Anyway, Scott Harriman, the owner there, has been in the restaurant industry in Huntsville for over 20 years, and he's been running Anaheim Chili now for about 4 years, and that's his original concept that he opened. They're doing great, and so this is kind of like a second location for him, and he's actually going to, as part of the deal we have where we kind of license those recipes and the name and logo and everything from him. It's basically kind of like a pseudo franchise arrangement.
Yeah.
But as part of it, since this is only the second location and we know him, he's actually going to be our general manager. So that will be huge in terms of having all that experience on the restaurant side, you know, that the rest of the ownership team did not have.
Yeah.
And if we were doing all this and you know, without someone like him, I think we would probably really fall on our face on the restaurant part. Just to kind of be honest with you, but
running a restaurant's a whole different beast, completely.
But we felt like, you know, as part of that whole thing about being in a smaller city, that we needed to be as inclusive as we could. And if we were just a bar, of course, then we're 21 and up only. And our expenses are a lot less, but still, you're really capped on what you can earn, you know, compared to having the restaurant, just because of the restricted age, you know. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's not so much that you're going to make a ton of money selling the food. You hope to make a little, but it's more that it just allows people to, you know, a whole family to come in on a Saturday and play games and do everything that they normally wouldn't be able to. So, we're gonna try to go full bore with this and see how it goes. That's a long answer for one question. Sorry.
That's fine. You got a lot of nice machines here. Which one are you most proud of? If there's this one,
it's a really tough thing to answer because I collected these in a fairly rapid period for the number of games. I say that the guy, Steve in Idaho, collected more in less time, but in our case, a lot of the stuff we got was needed significant restoration and repair. And so, you know, half of that, let's say we've been doing that for 3 years. Well, you know, 40 to 50% of that 3 years has been just restoring things and getting things working and, you know, capping monitors and putting on new side art and, you know, all the stuff you have to do.
Yeah.
And so there's a pride of just owning a game because it's one that you're very nostalgic for, because it's rare. And in that case, I would have to go with my Japanese Taito Space Invaders cabinet. Space Invaders here, pretty much, if you see it, it's the Midway version, which was, they were the U.S. distributor, basically, for Taito. But I have an imported Japanese cabinet.
Nice.
And so it looks a little different. The artwork is more colorful. It's a full color, vinyl artwork instead of the stencil. Now, I like the stencil job. I'm a fan of stencil art in general, to be honest with you. But somehow this just looks cooler on this case. And it actually has a joystick.
Huh.
You know, which, I mean, Space Invaders is a left-right button game.
Yeah.
It's to us. But apparently in Japan, it was a joystick game. Left-right joystick. So thought that was kind of neat, and I tend to prefer the just have a joystick than using two buttons to move it anyway. So I like that one a lot. It's not on the floor yet, but it will be. We have to get there's a monitor issue we have to deal with on it, and it's kind of a weird monitor. We'll figure it out. We'll get it on the floor when we can. But so definitely that one I'm very proud of. In terms of what's on the floor, maybe the Pac-Man, that was a pretty big just restoration job. You know, we stripped it down to, you know, we sanded it down pretty thoroughly, you know, did a lot of Bondo work on it. There was a whole, like, part of me almost hated to do this, but it was just too far gone. I mean, if it was a pretty good-looking game and it still had these carvings in it, I would have left them. But it was so far gone, I just had to kind of start over on it. But it basically had kind of like a high score table carved into the side of the game.
Wow.
So, I mean, they didn't have the scores, but they had basically carved their name in there if they had, like, the high score, and then you could see, like, names were scratched out and then had a name under it. So it had, like, maybe six or eight names, and they were all scratched except for the one on the bottom, you know. So they just started at the top and kept working their way. Somebody beat, you know, somebody, they scratched it out and carved in their name. Because Pac-Man didn't have initials, and it didn't have any high score table. It just had a number at the top. So they just made their own. And it's you know, it's, some people like to keep that stuff on the games. And like I said, I thought about it, but I don't know. I went ahead and just did the restore job. So they're whoever held the record is now, his name is now lost to history. But, but you know, I think if you look at the game, I just think it looks, you know, it's, I like I said before, I like stenciled art, and the Pac-Man and this Pac-Man art are some of the most complex stenciled art that you'll see.
Definitely.
And when they're done, you know, right, they just look so beautiful.
Yeah, it becomes like a literal work of art.
Yeah, it is. It really is. I mean, and so we've got a position to where you can really see that, you know, when you come in the door, and, you know, so that, I guess that definitely is one we're proud of.
Is there any machines that you really wanted to add to here, but you just diluted your drafts so far?
Yeah, Discs of Tron.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't gotten one of those yet, and I really want one. They're very expensive. They're just rare, and it's Tron, and so, they're, you know, those two things equal money.
Yeah.
So, we'll get one at some point. But we just gotta find the right deal, and I you know, I try not to ship stuff so much anymore because stuff gets damaged.
Yes,
and you know, it's one thing to buy a game that's, or you know, like say you get a bulk deal and you get like, you know, six or eight games, and you know, but the average price is, you know, $400 or $300 or something, and then you pay an additional $500 or $600 to have them all shipped, and if one of them gets a little damaged or something, well, it might have been a project anyways, but. You know, if you go spend like $3,500 on this Disc of Tron, and then it gets, you know, crushed somehow by a, you know, forklift in the warehouse on the way to you, that's a real heartbreaker. So,
yeah.
I will get one. You can't get everything in a couple of years. You know, it just takes time. Sometimes you're going to have that game that just takes time. And so that one's probably at the top of my list. There's others, but that one's definitely at the top of my list.
Out of what you got, what's been the hardest to get a hold of?
Mr. Do. That was... do you guys know that game, by the way?
No, yeah,
I know a little
got
bit
one
about
yes, one no. Okay. So, you know, Universal, the company that made that, I mean, they probably had some original games, but the three games that are kind of considered their best and most well-known are Mr. Do, Cosmic Avenger, and Ladybug, and they're basically all knockoff games. You know, Ladybug is kind of a Pac-Man clone, and you know, the Cosmic Avenger is a oh gosh, what's it called? Scramble clone, and Mr. Do is basically a Dig Dug.
Okay.
But they did a great job of two things. They took the game and they made some enough changes to it to where it became its own unique game and interesting, and generally they added complexity.
So it's more than just a reskin.
Right. It's definitely more than a reskin. You know, with Ladybug, you're trying to eat, you know, dots in a maze, more or less. But you also have these swinging gates that you can use to block off the enemy bugs. And that adds a ton of strategy. They also added kind of almost like a pinball element where you can collect letters to spell a word. So, like, if you hit drop targets on a pinball game, maybe you spell a word and you get some bonus.
Yeah.
They have that. You can actually earn. How many video games have you ever heard of where you can earn a free game? Where you can do something in the game to where you can actually get a credit to where you can play a whole another game afterwards? That doesn't happen in video games.
No.
That's a pinball concept, right?
Yeah.
But they put that in some of their video games. You can. I can't remember if you can do that in Ladybug, but I know you can do it in Mr. Do. There's this diamond that you can get. It's very rare, but there's ways that you can try to get it. And if you do, you actually get a whole new game.
Huh.
I mean, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And they have, again, they have things that you can spell and bonuses you can get for that. So, you know, it adds, it's one of those things that it adds complexity, but it's complexity that you can choose to ignore and just play the game in its most simplest mode, in which case it's 90% like whatever they cloned, you know, but... If you care to pay a little closer attention, you find more depth. And so I think they did a great job with those. And so Mr. Do is easy to find in terms of games that have been converted to it. It's just hard to find ones that it's a dedicated cabinet.
Yeah.
And so I said they did two things great. One was all the little changes that they would make to make the game more fun and add more depth. And the other one was the cabinets themselves from the front. From the sides, they just have this kind of 70s sort of striping look that's, you know, kind of cool now, but it's not, you know, it doesn't have the kind of really cool looking art that like Missile Command or Dig Dug or something has, or Asteroids or something. But from the face, they added an extended bezel behind the main monitor bezel that's backlit. And they did the artwork so that it would continue the same art scene from the back bezel down through the main bezel glass. And so when the whole thing is on and lit up, they just look beautiful. The artwork on them is just amazing. And so Mr. Do definitely is a just a, when you have the dedicated one, it's just a beautiful game to look at. And it's a ton of fun.
Well, on that note, you ever think about running MAME cabinets or anything like that?
No. We want to run original hardware. You know, I mean, that's a topic we could spend a lot of time on, so I'll try and go too much into it. There are rare exceptions where we're willing to run a modern board as a replacement for original hardware. And in all cases, we have the original hardware. It's just a matter of... Some systems are known to be more problematic, you know, I mean, chips overheating and whatnot, and there's always things you can do to try and bulletproof a little bit, but at the same time, if there's a modern replacement board that is spot on 100% accurate for the original, why not? I mean, I look at it as why not go ahead and, you know, this is a business. I mean, having to, you know, pay guys to fix games is cost money.
Yeah.
If we can do that and it work and be reliable and someone who's really, really amazingly good at that game can come in and play it and not tell the difference, then I don't really see the harm. So, and in the case of, and to give you an example of that, Joust.
Mm-hmm.
So, you guys were talking about earlier that you had spoken to the Berserk record, Joel.
Yeah.
I'll try to make this story quick, but do you guys know who Lonnie McDonald is?
I don't.
Okay.
The name rings somewhat of a bell.
He's one of, I won't say the, but one of the world record holders in Joust. There's depending on the settings and whatnot, there's different people on different records.
Yeah.
So he doesn't own all of them, but he owns at least one, I know. And he's an amazing Joust player. And he did kind of this tour a few years ago where he went around the country. I'm not sure. I think maybe his job has him traveling a lot. And so he made a mission kind of it to so Joust has a high score mechanism to where it kind of rolls over like a car odometer and it goes back to zero. I mean, a lot of games do that. But when you do that and then you finish your game, you'll just get a score of however many nines it can hold. You know, even though you rolled it during gameplay, it doesn't put that on the scoreboard. It was smart enough that they, or maybe lucky enough or whatever, I don't know, but to where, you know, when you finish, you actually put your initials in, it'll just put a score of like 9 million and then all nines after that. So he kind of made it, and, you know, the high score, the world record high scores are way beyond that number. But anyways, he kind of just decided to be fun or whatever to, or challenge to do that to 100 machines, to roll that over. And, you know, put an all nines high score on 100 different Joust machines around the country. And he's logged it with the serial numbers of all the machines, and he knows where they were, all were, and, you know, everything. And he did that a couple of years ago. And then since then, I think he's now kind of on a new thing where he's trying to roll at least one machine in every state. He's got a handful of states left he hasn't done yet. And so... a couple weeks ago, we get a Facebook message from Lonnie McDonald, and he says, you know, hey, do you have a dedicated Joust machine? And then, you know, and then, like, he has kind of put in a kind of like a SIG, you know, like Joust world record holder or something like that, you know. And I was just like, you know, and he said something later about it, you know, because I'm sure he thought, you know, this guy has no idea who I am or whatever. And I was like, he said something to kind of indicate, you know, like who he is, and besides just the SIG, and I said, No worries. I know who you are. You're among friends. You know, I said, yeah, we've got one. And, you know, and he says, you know, I'd like to come up and play it. And you know, put a max high score on it. And I said, we'd love for you to do that. You know, we think that'd be awesome. When were you thinking of you know, when were we going to be in the area or whatever? He says, I'm driving through Alabama today.
Oh, man.
oh my goodness, you know, like, well, I tell you what, man, we're not open yet. But you know, I get it, you're coming through, you know, we're gonna open the door for you. Come on in and, you know, and play. And we'll get the machine set up and you can play. And so he says, okay, well, I'll be getting in around dinner time if you want to grab a bite, and then, you know, we can go back and play. Sure. Okay. So we had dinner and just chatted about stuff, and then we came back and he sat down, and we had a hiccup with the game at first, of course. It had to die after, you know, but it was only like 10 minutes in or something, if that.
Yeah.
So we reset it, or, you know, figured out the problem, got it working again. And, of course, I told you about using this board that, you know, is so reliable. It actually wasn't the board's fault, so it was another issue. But anyway, he played it. It took him 4.5 hours. And, yeah, it takes him between 4 or 5 hours, depending on how good of a game he has. He's amazing to watch. I mean, absolutely amazing. And it's a combination of things. You know, he knows he knows the AI of the game, like, better than the programmers, basically.
Yeah. Yeah,
and he just has the reflexes and the speed and whatever, and, you know, his CPU on that is just running, you know, so fast that he can just react to things, you know, very quickly. And it was fun to watch him. But yeah, I mean, that runs, and he told us, you know, I told him, I said, it's run J-Rock, which is the sort of pseudonym of the guy who wrote this multi-waves replacement board. And, you know, modern, it's a FPGA board. And he said, you know, oh, I love J-Rock. They're great. They're perfect. You can't tell the difference. I mean, I'm saying, look, if Lionel McDonald can come in here and say, I can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The layman man.
Then, you know, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with running that. But anyway, for the most part, 90% of our games are all original hardware.
That's good. Yeah. On the note of high scores, are y'all going to do any like high score events or keep record of like high score set on machines?
Yeah, we've got a couple of big blackboard marker boards that to track that stuff on. So it'll be a kind of thing where you just have to get a server or, you know, someone to come over and kind of verify your score.
Yeah.
You know, we'll put it up there. And of course, the fun thing is we're going to put Lonnie on there with his nine all nines joust. He's the first, you know, one on the board, you know, and it'll never go away because you can't really beat that. We didn't really track what his actual score was. It was just, you know, he just wanted to roll it.
Yeah.
And by the way, he set that score, and then it took him, I think, probably 15 minutes at least, maybe 20 minutes, to just kill off all of his extra lives. He had so many, you know, like 150 or more. We didn't recount them, but well over 100 lives in reserve. So we just ran them into lava over and over and over again until finally he could put his initials in.
Yeah, I mean, man,
that's insane, isn't it?
When we were interviewing Joel West, he's talking about setting the record for, not Berserk, what's the console version?
Frenzy.
Frenzy. He's talking about setting the
it's like the sequel.
Yeah. Yeah, he was talking about setting the record for playing that long.
And had like 100 and...
What was his plan for doing a bathroom break and trying to set the world's record and playing it along? He said, well, I get so many lives, I got so many minutes I can walk away and use the bathroom.
Yes, he's wanting to do the longevity record, yeah. Like do the 48-hour straight marathon or something like that.
I think
that.
It's 72.
It's a ridiculous amount of time.
Yeah, certain games, you can stockpile enough lives to where you can actually go to sleep for like an hour.
Yeah.
And still be alive on your game and come back up and keep playing. And that's what they've done. Like, Q-Bert is one of those where they've, you know, the world record in terms of, well, I mean, it's one of those things where in order to set the score record, you more or less have to set the time record. So,
yeah.
But, you know, it takes like 3 or 4 days. It's ridiculous. But they plan it out, and they know, I think they generally will have someone there with them to track how many lives they have and so forth. So if they, you know, starting to get into trouble, they get running low on lives, they can wake them up or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, yeah, but now on Joust, you can't do that because you do die fast enough to where he was telling us that you can only have, I think, you know, 255 lives. So they just, you know, have a bite to track lives. And so,
yeah.
But like on Q-Bert, it can store a higher number. So you can get, you know, hundreds, many hundreds, and you can, and I don't know how long it takes. The other factor, there's two factors, right? How many lives you can have in reserve, and then how long does it take one of them to die?
Yeah.
If you just do nothing. And you know, you die pretty fast on Joust on the higher levels. I'm not sure what it's like on Qbert, so I couldn't speak about that. But anyway,
it's like the Pac-Man trick where you can pack, you like park him in a little corner. And you're supposed to go around him all the time.
Yeah. Pac-Man, just before we get off the high score sort of topic, you know, which we've kind of wandered onto. If you don't track, I don't know if you guys track that much at all, but you know, Billy is kind of regarded as like the first person to do the, do a perfect game, right? And but the interesting thing about that is because that's there's this concept of a perfect game, that was in terms of score, but there's now kind of evolved a new way to compete at that, and which is in time,
to get
the perfect game, but to do it faster. And so they're having to find new patterns, you know, to so that they can get through the boards, but still get all the, you know, bonus from all the ghosts and all the fruit and everything, and you know, and never die, but do it, you know, in so many seconds, you know, faster than the current record.
Yeah.
And I just find that amazing that there are people out there who are so competitive about that, and so let's face it, you have to somewhat be just obsessed about it. To figure that stuff out, and nowadays they can use MAME and things like that as tools to help them in determining, you know, that because you can save states and stuff like that. So I mean that helps, but nevertheless, just the fact that they can even do that at all is just amazing to me. And I saw a video of a guy doing it, and like I don't know if you've ever watched like people solve Rubik's cubes and then seen like a computer solve a Rubik's cube, and they don't look anything alike generally.
Yeah,
you know, the computer is kind of turning it, but you don't really see the order. You don't really see what it's doing, and then all of a sudden, in like three or four moves, it just all comes together. Whereas in the human, you see them, you know, they're like top down, and you know they'll do a side, and you know the computer doesn't really do that because it doesn't have to think that way. It can see the whole cube all the time.
Yeah.
So. These guys are basically developing Pac-Man patterns that are kind of like the computer cube patterns. They'll leave like a single dot. You know, they're eating a row of dots, and then there's like one more to finish before there's like a gap or something, and they'll turn and leave that dot sitting there, which nobody would ever do.
Yeah.
But they have to do it in order to get to a turn before a ghost gets there or something, you know, as part of their pattern. And so they wind up doing some very weird things, but it always works out in the end. And of course, they also know that they can go through ghosts at certain points. So part of the pattern is time to, you know, run into a ghost actually right at a certain point to where you can exploit that bug or whatever. And I don't know the details of that bug, but I know they're if you watch them do those patterns, you'll see that every now and then they'll just go right through a ghost.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but I love that stuff. I love watching that stuff.
Yeah, it's insane. Not only are they running perfect games, but I can do it faster than you, and I can break the game to do it. You know?
Yeah.
As far as arcade games go, is there a game you excel at more than others? Or just a personal favorite?
Honestly, not really. I told my buddies earlier that I have kind of a little goal in the back of my mind where once this thing's finally up, because I've been collecting all these games, spending so much time collecting and restoring these games, I almost never play them. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping that I will get to a point where once we're kind of stable and in a groove with this thing, to where I can play a little bit. Because I do obviously enjoy playing the games.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the answer is going to be yet, but I want to find something that I can be good enough at to have the, you know, our little local high score. Yeah. And I'm not trying to go for any world records or anything. Yeah. But if I just good enough to where I can actually have the local high score. So I think if I can find one and spend a little time just focusing on that one, maybe I can do that. But I haven't really figured out which one that's going to be yet. I'm okay at Ms. Pac-Man. I mean, not truly competitive, you know, in terms of the world, but I specifically really mean the with the speed hack, Ms. Pac-Man.
Oh, yeah, that's the best way.
Yeah, I mean, I love that one. And it's funny, though, I found that some people find that harder.
Really?
Because it just moves so fast that they can't, like, keep up with the, you know, turning in time and stuff like that. But to me, it's insanely easier because you're so fast and the ghosts are the same as they always were, you know, at the beginning.
Yeah,
and later on, they catch
a lot,
you know,
faster.
Yeah, so the first, you know, first like five or ten boards, you're so fast that you can just blow through them. It's still a little challenge in trying to get all the points for maximizing, you know, getting all the blue ghosts and stuff. But, I mean, I don't know. So, I mean, and the only reason I say that is because you could, you know, I could put a quarter in that and play that for maybe 20 or 30 minutes if I have a really good game. But a lot of times there, you know, as it gets later, like at the beginning, I'm trying to eat every ghost and get all the points. But then, you know, as they start getting faster and the blue time starts to ramp down, I just basically start eating the maze and just blowing through.
Trying to survive.
Yeah, yeah, just to see how many screens I can get through before it's over. So, but no, I wouldn't even say I'm really even that particularly great at that. It's just I don't know. I got to find something, though. I got to find something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's going to be. I know it's not going to be Joust.
We had
I'm terrible at Joust.
Oh, I am too.
Absolutely.
We had some questions from social media, and that was one of
okay.
the games where you good at and what's your high score. Galaga guy sent us an email. He said he's asking, are kids allowed to come play, and is there going to be family nights? Which I think you
oh, yeah, yeah. Kids are welcome. We talked about doing, we had said, actually, publicly even, that we were going to be 19 and up after 7 p.m., and family-friendly before that, and the only exception being Sundays where we close at 8, so we just would be family-friendly all day. Then we got some questions from the Beverage Control Board about whether that was allowed or not. Like, they weren't sure, but they thought maybe that wasn't something we were allowed to do with a restaurant license. It was different types of liquor licenses, and ours is a restaurant license. And so that allows us to be all ages. And it's my understanding that we could be more restrictive than that if we wanted to, even just at certain times of the day. And I still think that that's probably true.
But that would make the most sense.
They thought that they just weren't sure. And I'll put it that way. They didn't say, you can't do that. They just said, I'm not so sure that you can do that. You might want to check or something like that. So we're working on getting the answer to that. But at the same time, I think we're just going to go ahead and launch with just being all ages all the time and see how it goes. We don't want to have too many, you know, there's a couple of issues here. One is you don't want to have a lot of problems with underage folks trying to drink.
Yeah.
We are, you know, we're a restaurant, but we're pretty, you know, we have a pretty heavy focus on the bar part of our restaurant. And I could see that, you know, we're going to have to be really diligent about not serving underage folks.
Yeah.
So, you know, and one way to do that is to just have an age cutoff. Even if you're at 19 or 20, at least you're not, you know, you're reducing the problem. You're still going to have some that you have to watch out for. I don't know. And then the other thing is just if you're trying to create a place where people who are in their 20s or early 30s are going to hang out on a Friday night, if that place is overrun with 12-year-olds, then it doesn't matter how cool they would otherwise find it, they're not really going to be there.
Yeah, you're also going to have the issue of some not-so-great parents that might come in and hammer away the beer while their kids are running wild.
Yeah, 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 right. So we just have to kind of – we're really just going to kind of watch and see how it goes and see what the behavior what patterns we see from our customers. And if things are cool, we'll just stay – the way we are, you know, we'll just stay family friendly all the time. Meanwhile, we'll make sure we understand legally what our options truly are, and just keep that as a backup plan in case we need it. But I mean, we're in downtown Huntsville, so the immediate area is not really surrounded by, you know, families. You know, I mean, with like, you know, 8-year-olds and 12-year-olds and what. I mean, it's really. Yeah, actually, the immediate area is mostly folks that are much older,
yeah.
Right? I mean, the people who can afford to live in these homes downtown, I mean, they're pretty rich,
yeah.
Largely. And if you've looked at these old historic homes anyway, now they're building all of these apartments, like, right, I mean, two blocks away,
yeah, we know,
200
we
apartment units. Earlier.
And like I mentioned to him, they'd be lucky if you get cheaper than $2,000 a month there, probably.
I mean, I think that thing is going to largely be populated by young professionals.
Yeah.
And some empty nest folks that want to downsize, but I think you're going to have more young professionals there. That's perfect for us.
Yeah.
So I think that's where I think for the nighttime crowd, I think we would maybe just organically be what we want to be without having to enforce any rules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to try and see. And then that way we can be, you know, during the summer or whatever, you know, kids can come in during the day. He gets to always come in on the weekends. And we want, I mean, I've been to a lot of these arcade expos, like you talked about, like, you know, Southern Fried. You guys have probably seen this. You go there, and one of the things that you see happen a lot is someone who's, you know, maybe in their 40s or 50s or whatever, and they're there with a young child, and they're showing them these games. And, yeah. and the kids are, you know, enjoying it, and they're I mean, checking out these games. They've never, I mean, they don't, we don't have, like you said, there's not a lot of, I mean, we, man, in 83, you could go anywhere, and there was games. There was video games at Walmart, at the convenience store, at the grocery store, at the music store. You know, just in, you go into a mall, and not only is there an arcade, there's an actual arcade, but there's games just at, you know, in different areas of the mall, just out in the walk areas, you know, against the wall. And they were just all over the place. But in today's world, it's pretty rare. So there's all kinds of games here that, you know, those kids have never seen. And we want them to be able to get exposed to that stuff and have fun playing those games, and especially pinball. They've never seen pinball.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, that's been effectively dead. I mean, over and over I hear people say, oh, I didn't even know they still made them. You know, Stern is still cranking out games, and there's some other, you know, boutique companies that have kind of popped up and are trying to make a go of it. But, you know, they're to the point where they make one game every few years, and Stern makes, you know, multiple games per year. So they're on a completely different level. But, I mean, they're still cranking them out, but they've gotten down to where it was just Stern for a while. And so, yeah, there's not tons of pinballs out there. A lot of these kids don't know how to play. They don't even know how to start the game, much less, you know, flip or save a ball or, you know, nudge or anything. I mean, forget that.
I know me and him pretty much grew up in an arcade and pinball drought. There's not much where we were. You know, Coleman's not a big place anyway.
My most arcade experience I had, my dad owned a Galaga machine when I was little.
Oh, nice.
Like two or three. He had Galaga, and we had RoboCop at our grocery store. That's literally all I remember.
Anytime my parents were coming to Decatur, I begged them to come and play at the Decatur Mall where they had an arcade there, because that was just the coolest thing. That and our skating rink had a small arcade area.
And I got to meet, I'm not sure, but I bet you I know the guy who ran that arcade.
Really?
I bought a couple of games from him, and he's an old, you know, arcade operator. He'd been, you know, he ran stuff all around this area from back in the 80s, and he still has some stuff on location now, but you know, back then he had tons of stuff probably. But it's funny, the people you meet collecting all these games, you know.
Talking about the newer games we made, Jason on Facebook, he asked, will you ever have a Sky Cursor cabinet available to play? Have you seen Sky Cursor?
This just in, we have a Sky Cursor in our possession.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you know, we bought the mod kit, so you can buy a full cabinet that they go ahead and build out for you and ship, or you can buy the conversion kit. And, I mean, basically all their stuff is made to work on, there's, you know, kind of set up to where it will it's most readily suited for us, put it that way. The Dynamo cabinets, which are a generic cabinet that was made to just kind of hold whatever.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, several of those in our warehouse. And so I've got one that I've kind of earmarked for conversion to Sky Cursor. Absolutely. I think that's awesome. It's really neat that you got that question. I love that what they're doing. I met a couple of the guys at the Louisville Expo last year. Not that they just had one, but it was a year ago, and played it. It was in early stages then. They only had like the first stage complete. But you know, I love what they're doing. I mean, they're building retro style games, new games. They're putting, you know, a heavy emphasis on the art, making the art look really great and period sort of accurate, you know, in terms of the styling. They put elements of their, you know, the game. Have you played it? Did you see it?
I watched it. I haven't played it.
Okay. Played it.
I didn't know if it was at Southern Fried or not, but they, you know, it's got like three or four different weapons that you can get to shoot with your ship, and you can have them all at the same time. So normally in shoot 'em ups, like, you have a gun, and then if you get some power up, it changes you to something else.
Yeah, and you start revolting power up sometimes.
Sometimes you want to keep what you have, right? And then, you know, sometimes you might get like kind of a bomb type effect that you can use on a secondary button, and you only have so many of them, stuff like that.
Yep.
But with this game, you can have multiple weapons that you can choose to use at any given time, and certain enemies are more readily killed with a specific type of weapon than others. So you kind of need to learn the enemies and how the weapon, the feel for the weapons, and kind of, you know, you'll maximize your score and your survivability if you can kill the enemy with the right weapon.
Yeah, I like that. It kind of brings a little bit of a modern twist to the old style.
Yeah, I mean, it's
shooter.
A little bit of a it's a little bit of like a first person shooter concept going into a shoot 'em up.
Yeah,
and they specifically really looked at Doom for their inspiration for that. And it actually impacts both the gameplay in that way, but also a little bit on the art style. They've got the guy's little face down at the bottom or whatever, mm-hmm. and stuff, and that was kind of pulled a little bit from the Doom sort of feel, too. So
yeah.
I think it's really neat what they're doing, and then the fact that they also created not just a game, but a development platform. So they have, I think it's called Airframe or something like that, and they're running their game on that platform, but it's made so that, you know, other developers will be able to write for that platform as well and do, you know, what they're doing too. So they're trying to not just create a company but an industry, or at least a sub industry, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how I see it anyways, and I think that's phenomenal. I'd love to see more of that. There's like I said before, there's all these boutique pinball companies that are kind of popping up now that there's a bit of a resurgence. And I root for all those guys, too. But we haven't seen, outside of the Sky Cursor, you know, guy, and I'm struggling now to remember their development team's name.
I don't recall.
But really, outside of them, I haven't seen anyone writing and trying to sell actual arcade cabinets that are retro style.
Yeah.
I've seen plenty of vintage style games on, you know, the App Store, and then, you know, or on Xbox, or, you know, Steam, what, take your pick, you know, some kind of downloadable game service. There's tons of arcade style stuff, you know, 8-bit graphic stuff, and that's cool. And I think you know, that's connected to the whole resurgence of interest in just, you know, all the retro gaming and everything. But I want to see more actual arcade games that are made, yeah. you know, commercial games. They're made to go on location and take a beating and earn money. That's it. I mean, you got to remember that the arcade games are not just a game. They're supposed to be simultaneously a game and a business.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's something that's still kind of lost, and they're trying to bring it back, and I hope there's more like them that do that.
That'd be really cool.
We'll have one. It probably won't be on the floor when we launch. You know, our it definitely won't be for our soft opening. I'm hoping I can get it ready for the grand opening. And we don't have a date that we can really put out there for the soft opening, or there wouldn't be all of that soft opening. But the grand opening, you know, we're saying April 9th, and we feel pretty good about that. But yeah, hopefully I can get the Sky Cursor ready by then. I would love to. It's a cool game. We're going to have it.
I'm definitely going to have to come check it out.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it. If you like shoot-em-ups at all, I mean, it's
That's
a cool
something game. Else I want to ask you. Any chance of you getting a Dodonpachi machine?
Maybe.
I punched my arcade cabinet a couple times playing that game.
I have a candy cab, you know. You know what those are, right?
The Japanese
sort of sit down. They're like a plastic
and
metal.
It's like the Street Fighter cab we played up in.
And usually have big monitors, and, you know, they're just generic. I mean, you can kind of, some of them have little places you can put in little thin, like, paper marquees behind a piece of plexiglass or something. But they don't have a lot of artwork on them for the most part. They just, you know, they're just the joysticks and buttons, and you just kind of throw a board in there and let the screen kind of advertise for you instead of having, like, all the art and stuff.
Yeah.
And, so I have one of those, and I have a handful of different shoot 'em up games that we can put in there and rotate out. You know, that cab probably won't be on the floor at launch either, but we'll get it in here within the first few months. And I don't have a Dodonpachi or anything like that yet, but I don't know if I have anything by Cave. Well, have you ever played Pro Gear No Arashi? So that's one that I do have, and it's bullet hell. I mean, it's like big time. It's a horizontal,
okay.
It's a lot of fun. But we'll have different. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones that we have. We have one called Sorker Striker or something like that. I don't remember. I'm not. I've got to be honest. I can get out of my depth on shmup stuff real fast. I'm not real. You know, I haven't been a big part of that scene or anything. I have a few boards. I haven't spent a lot of time playing them yet. I kind of bought them, you know, just for the business, really. And so we're going to put them out there. I actually want to get to play some of them.
Yeah.
Some of them look really fun. I just haven't actually had time to get and dig into them yet. But so I can't even list for you right now the names, but I could probably get them for you later or something. But,
okay.
But we definitely want to cater to that crowd, you know. You know, we've identified certain genres of classic games that we feel like we need to have. You know, you need to have some fighters. You know, so we've got a Street Fighter II, you know, it's the anniversary edition where you can pick, you know, like Turbo or Super Hyper or whatever. And then, you know, Mortal Kombat 2 and a Killer Instinct and, you know, and we've got others where we can rotate in. But, you know, we're not all about that, but we want to make sure we have at least a few for the folks that's their thing. And, you know, NBA Jam, you kind of got to have that. And,
yes,
you know,
yes.
You know, side-scrolling beat-em-ups, you know, you got to have some of those. And so we're trying to have different genres, and we definitely want to have some shmups. And, you know, right now we've got 1943, and that's really about it. I mean, except to the extent that you consider the really old-school shmups like Galaga.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, in terms of, you know, what in the modern thinking of when you say shmup, I mean, the history of, I mean, everything started with Space Invaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the one that made the biggest change that led to what we have now, I think, was 1942, where you had the boss ships come through, and you know, you could play side by side with someone, and you had different weapons and power ups, and I mean all that stuff that's carried through to today. That I think of, I'm pretty sure at least that really started with 1942 and the scrolling graphics and all that stuff. So we don't have a 42, we have a 43. So still pretty far back there.
Oh, yeah.
But we want to have some more modern bullet hell type stuff too.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
They're going to be doing any tournaments with, like, the Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat and stuff?
Yeah, we do. We haven't really set any specific plans for that yet. We certainly don't have any dates for that set yet. You know, we're just so focused right now on just getting open.
Yeah.
And just trying to get things running smoothly and everything working and all that.
Catch your breath before you can do that kind
of
thing.
Yeah. But we definitely want to have, you know, the occasional fighting game tournament. Or even, like, I don't know if anyone's ever done this, but a league. Could you have a fighting game league?
That'd be awesome.
Maybe.
That'd be
fun, wouldn't it?
That'd be kind of cool.
Or, you know, NBA Jam League. Or, you know, I mean, I think doing some competitive stuff like that, social. I mean, part of the whole thing about this, that's why the concept works is because it's social.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so having leagues and having tournaments is ties into that directly. You know, I mean, everyone can play a million games on their phone and never leave their house. But despite that, people still love coming to these types of businesses. So part of the reason is there's a lot of reasons, but one of them is the social nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, we're going to support having, you know, and of course in pinball as well, you know, tournaments and then or what they call pin golf, where you set objectives on each machine, and then it's like how many balls does it take you to accomplish the objective? You know, so it's like strokes, you know, in golf.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you can play it and have fun, and not have it take all day. You know, that's one thing. I mean, if you get someone who's really good at a game, and it's a game where it's just like about points and how long you can play.
Oh yeah, they'll say for hours.
Play for hours. I mean, suddenly you really can't do a tournament or you can't do a league because it just takes up all night. So you have to find ways to do it to where even that really great player isn't going to be on there all day long.
Yeah.
So pinball is so hard that generally speaking, you know, as long as you've got the game set up right, even a really good player can't play for like an hour or something.
Yeah.
That's something we've kind of done. We're starting a small game convention in Coleman.
Yeah.
And the trial run we did last year, he set up some speed run tables. And he's like, you got 5 minutes to get as far as you can. That
okay.
Way.
We did some like Super Mario speed run and stuff like that.
They did two things at Louisville that I thought were good in that regard. And one was the Galaga tournament on Sunday. So they had their game set up with fast bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to play for 3 minutes. I think it was three. Something pretty short. And, you know, it made it for an interesting choice because what do you want to do first in Galaga almost always?
Get the two ships.
Get the second ship, right? You want to get captured, get the second ship so you can start mowing stuff down. But you're on fast bullet, so you can kind of already mow stuff down a little bit. It's not quite the same as having the two ships, but getting the second ship takes a lot of time.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
You know, you're investing like 15 or 20 seconds maybe out of your 3 minutes to get that second ship. So is it going to pay off? And I don't know I watched a bunch of people play, and I don't know if it was ever definitively answered. I saw people near the top that did and that did not get the second ship. I thought that was really interesting the way they had it set up. So you had to make a decision and then just go with it. And it was over quickly, no matter how good you were. And it could push through a lot of people in a short amount of time. And it was fun. And then the other thing they did was the what they call the Fire Mario challenge. So that was a timed thing, a speed run mm-hmm. thing. You had to complete the first stage 1-1 or whatever of Super Mario Brothers and finish the level as what they called Fire Mario, where you had the fireballs. Mm-hmm. So if you lose your flower or whatever, you can't win. Right.
I mean, you disqualify.
Yeah, I mean, you'll lose. So the first thing you have to do is you have to successfully get through the thing with the fireballs.
Yeah.
And then it's about who did that the fastest. And so that has also got a fixed amount of duration. I mean, no one's just going to sit there for half an hour, right? I mean,
yeah.
You're going to be over. You're going to be done like in a minute, or however, I don't know how long it takes to get through that stage, but not that long.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, challenges like that that you can do quickly and people can just jump in. The rules are easy to explain. You can just jump in and play and just make it a fun social event.
Definitely be the key. You know, we're trying to do a bigger game fest this year. And we're trying to incorporate all kinds of stuff like that. Just
cool.
To see how it turns out.
Okay, cool. So you did one already, and you're doing a second one coming up?
Yeah, we did a test run in our Civic Center and just rented, one of the side rooms.
Okay.
And, we had, five cabinets and about 30 consoles hooked up. And
wow, that's a good number of consoles.
We had about...
Do you two own most of those just yourselves?
Yeah.
Or?
Okay.
But that was all his had, then. Now I went from almost zero consoles to 20-something.
Whoa. So.
The only ones we're pretty much lacking right now is a Neo Geo and
Jaguar.
TurboGrafx CD, Jaguar, some of the more expensive ones.
Now, are you running on CRTs?
Yes.
Okay, awesome.
We have a storage unit we rent that's got about
40 TVs.
What's great about CRTs is some people just giving them away.
Yes, they do.
I just look on Craigslist.
You can find them on the side of the road.
But we found a few on the side of the road, actually.
Yeah. And they usually work.
Yeah.
I mean, they just it's this huge box they want to get rid of, and no one will pay them for it, so they just put it out there.
We found a couple that didn't work, and all it required was us changing the fuses in it.
Oh, really?
Pretty much,
Wow, cool. But, yeah. I need to start finding some of those, because some of them you can actually use for arcade monitors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of, gold in this hobby, is having good monitors ready to go.
Yep.
You get something and it's got a bunch of burn on it. Those old CRTs are so few caps and it's right back alive, so you can't kill them except for by burning them. Obviously if you neck the tube it's dead for life then. But I mean, but other than burn, I mean, they're electronically, they'll just go and go and go. Caps dry out, you put new caps in or whatever. You may have to replace a pot or something. But I mean, they just, they're awesome. And they look so beautiful. I mean, I could never, it just bums me out anytime I see that someone's advertising their arcade game that has an upgraded monitor.
LCD screen. Yeah.
It's like, no, it's not.
I enjoy playing these old games on my computer monitor, but it's just not the same.
It isn't. The artist created those graphics on that media. So
And in some cases, it can have some performance issues too. A lot of these new LCDs have little delays.
Yes.
So
yes, yes, and on certain games, that can matter.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, big time. One thing, y'all plan on having a console room here as well?
Yes.
Right?
And it sounds like you guys are the folks I need to talk to to help make that thing what it can be and should be. Because I. It's, right now we really have a Super Nintendo and I'm not sure how many games, but let's say about 10 games. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of in its fledgling stages. We need to really expand it both in number of consoles and in more games for them. And we'll do that for sure. It's just a matter of, it's kind of funny. I somehow kind of skipped a generation or maybe two generations of console gaming. I grew up in the 2600 and ColecoVision and, you know, Intellivision and all that kind of era. And then, and I, you know, for me, the thing I played the most was the Commodore 64.
That's one of the ones. I got a Commodore VIC-20 not long ago. I love that thing.
And I went to college, and I didn't have any money, and I was just barely able to, you know, go at all. And so the idea of buying, you know, a console, buying games for it and stuff just was completely not even on the radar at all.
Yeah.
And so I just kept playing games on my Commodore all the way through college. And what was happening while I was there? Well, Nintendo came out. I mean, the Famicom and, you know, the NES and Super and, you know, Sega. And, I mean, all that stuff happened in that very late 80s or very early 90s time period where I was either at college or just getting out and trying to, you know, get started in the world as a coder. And so and I pretty much went from that straight into just PC gaming. So I really never played those sort of mid-level history of, you know, consoles. Played the very early stuff, and of course I played like Xbox and things more recently, but, you know, and I think I kind of started picking back up around PS2, I guess.
Yeah.
So for me, there's kind of this hole where I didn't really play a ton of, like, Super Mario Bros. 3, you know, or whatever, Star Fox or whatever. I mean, there's all these great games that I just didn't get a lot of experience with. I could play a little bit if I went to a friend's house or, you know, a family member's cousin or something, visit them and play on theirs. So I got some exposure to it, but... That's kind of like the weakest area of gaming for me, like in terms of knowledge and experience and everything, is in that era of consoles, you know.
Yeah, we grew up with the Nintendo and Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
I know by the time the Dreamcast came out is when I went straight PC gaming.
Okay.
And so that's
PC Master Race.
Yeah. Yeah. The PC had so many great 90s games.
Oh, like, yeah.
Baldur's Gate. Yeah. I could play that so much.
Yeah.
I played Diablo. That was about it.
Diablo was
my
great.
PC gaming.
Oh, I mean, that's
Myst.
That's an all-time classic PC game for me. I mean, loved that game. Played it so long. You know, do you remember... So you played Diablo, like, when it was the first out, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember the hacking scene?
Yes.
And the duping?
Yes. My friend had one of those not the hack program you could bring up where you're playing. You could like highlight a player and just kick them off the server. And
yeah.
I was just like, dude, that's such a dick move.
Well, that's
dude,
where man. I kind of got my first... I kind of get my first dealings with coding in. I'm not a professional coder, but, you know, I do dabble in it.
Okay.
And that's where I kind of got started learning how to hack games and stuff.
Okay.
Starting with hex editors and that kind of stuff. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You can't do that with modern games because they do it all server-side.
Yeah.
You hack your client and think you're doing something until you die.
Yeah, there's folks that can do it. I mean, can sort of do it. I mean, you know, people write bots and all this stuff.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder now than it was back then. But I mean, I remember because I actually wound up joining a guild, I guess, or whatever. You know, no, I can't remember if they called it, you know, a clan or a guild or what.
Yeah, that's before they even like, implemented anything in game for that.
Right,
just
there
a
was
group
right.
of guys.
Yeah. Right, there was nothing in game at all, and there wasn't really that much of a reason to be in any kind of a guild or anything at the time for that game, except that at least for me, and what I found was that there was some guilds popped up, and their whole reason for existing was to be anti-cheat.
Yeah.
So they'd say, look, if you want to go play a single player by yourself and you want to create, you know, I just pick items out of a, you know, thing and drop them onto your character, knock yourself out. But if you want to go online, people in this guild want to play totally cheat free.
Yeah.
So this is a guild where you can come and play with other people who are like-minded, play the game the way the developers intended, and know that you're not, you know, someone's not going to come in and like full godly play and wipe you out or something. I actually formed a lot of friends in that game that I played, you know, went on to play like EverQuest with afterwards, and then went on to play like World of Warcraft with afterwards and stuff. It all started because of that whole cheat scene in Diablo.
Yeah.
It was kind of funny. And I mean, I did it. Everyone did it. But you do it and then you're like, okay, that was fun. But then, you know, there's no challenge. I mean, it was so beyond. You could give yourself the absolute maximum, you know, everything in 5 minutes. And so it was just like, well, okay, that was kind of interesting. But now I don't have a game anymore.
Yeah, you killed all the game players.
To me, it became killing the other hackers. Like, that was what I started doing, figuring out how to out-hack them and kill them, get around their god mode hacks and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And the funny thing was we had one guy in the guild whose job was kind of unofficially, I guess, but I mean, he basically had, I mean, he was the one guy in the guild that if he wanted to, he could cheat anytime he wanted to. And it wasn't really written that way, but the reason why I say that is because he had just, you know, all these dupe items and fake items and whatever, and the stuff that were really popular, you know, that everyone would get, you know, the rings with resist all maximum,
yes,
and, you know, everything. And every now and then, he would just randomly drop one on the ground in a game with other people. And if you if someone had that item, it would, and it detected a dupe, it would either delete the item or something would happen. I don't remember.
Yeah.
You could tell if somebody else had the exact same item.
Yeah.
So he would occasionally he would catch someone that was supposedly in our like no cheat guild, but they were cheating.
You gotta use a cheat to catch a cheater.
Yeah.
That's right. That was the only way to do it.
And
you couldn't really prove what they had. You could say, well, hey, drop all your armor. Well, you can just have stuff sitting in his inventory.
Exactly.
And so, you know, you couldn't prove it. But if he throws down that godly player, the whale, and it disappears, and he's just you and him, then you're busted.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah, Diablo was, I mean, and do you play D3 at all? Or?
I haven't. I own it, but I have not even played it yet.
Not once?
I bought it for PlayStation 3 from a guy, and I just now recently rejoined the PC Master Race. It got like a gaming PC. Actually, last week,
I have it. I was disgusted with the initial state of it at launch.
Yeah.
And I've heard it's gotten a lot better with Reaper of Souls.
Yeah.
But as I left such a bad taste in my mouth, I haven't got back into it.
I mean, if you like those kind of games and you like the whole Diablo sort of story and everything, not that it's a super deep story, but, you know, it's if you've been playing since the beginning, you've been following the story, so you're kind of invested in it.
Yeah.
I would definitely go check it out again now because it is so much better. I mean, it is just infinitely better. They almost went too far with the whole auction house thing.
Yeah,
because there's almost no economy now. So you're just kind of on your own. But on the other hand, you can pretty much, there are ways for you to get what you're wanting to put together your build. I mean, it's Diablo. You're going to have to grind some to get what you want. But, you know, you can put together some pretty fun builds pretty quick, and it's a lot of fun. That's the most recent game that I've actually spent, you know, a few hours on a weekend playing, which has been a while since I've been able to do that, but just because of the bar. But it's good.
Diablo's what instilled a real love of Gauntlet for me. I love the Gauntlet arcades.
Yeah, original.
Any of them.
Oh man, and I mean, that game made so much money when it first came out. I mean,
I can imagine.
Dudes would go into the arcade with a $20 bill and just planning to just put it all into Gauntlet. And this is, you know, in 85 or whatever. I mean, when that was, I mean, think of that as like 100 now.
Yeah.
You know, almost. Probably 60 or 80 maybe, you know. And just going into can you imagine today going into an arcade with like, you know, let's say 420s in your wallet, and I'm just going to put all of these into this game
machine. that'd be kind of rough.
I'm going to sit there for like, you know, 3 hours or whatever it is, and just play this game until my fingers bleed and I'm out of money, and then just be happy. I mean, but they did. I mean, they essentially did that. It was, and I was the guy who didn't have $20 to be able to put it to a game. I wished I could have. You know, I had maybe $1, and I was happy to get that much gaming out of it. But
hey, if you didn't have much, you go with an elf, and you could stay alive quite a while.
Yeah, that's right. Hang back, and you know what's funny about Gauntlet? You can actually play that game strategically. You can play it like where you know you can put in like one quarter and play for a good while.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a continuation game, so most people don't really think of it that way. They just play and they just charge into things and start swinging the axe and doing whatever. But you can learn how the enemies move and where they're going to spawn and all this stuff, and you can be much more strategic, and it takes you longer. But you can go a long way on you know, one or two quarters or something if you choose to play it that way.
Yeah.
It was a guy at the Southern Fried Expo that I bought that one, or it's around the corner, so you can't, I was trying to point at it. But I bought that one at that expo. And a guy there was actually showing me some tips and stuff on it, and I was like, wow, I didn't know you could play this way. For me, it was always just full speed ahead.
Yeah.
That's the way everyone always played it. But yeah, he was like, no, do this, do that. And at first, I was kind of annoyed. I was like, dude, just let me play, you know? But then I started realizing, I was like, he knows what he's talking about, you know? So then I started listening. Yeah, Gauntlet was kind of the start of all that in a way.
Yeah.
I say that. I mean, what was the game with Rogue? I mean, Rogue. Yeah. Rogue was really the start of
that. There's an entire genre named after it. You know.
Yeah, I mean, Diablo in some ways was just a graphical, less complicated, you know, sort of simpler, dumbed down Rogue.
Yeah.
I mean, with more story, you know, voice acting and all that. I mean, all the Blizzard production values that made it awesome. And I don't mean to knock it because I think I've already expressed that I love the Diablo series, but essentially that started from Rogue.
Yeah, it did. And we weren't lucky enough to grow up around Gauntlet, so I played Diablo first, and then I came across Gauntlet Legends or Legacy.
Yeah, Legacy. Yeah.
Legacy.
Dark Legacy, I think maybe.
Dark Legacy. That's it. It's currently Legends and Dark Legacy.
Yeah,
and that's it.
Yeah.
One of those two I came across. I was like, oh, this is real Diablo-like, and that led me to find the older Gauntlet games and really enjoy those.
I've never played those 3D Gauntlets.
They're okay. They're a big departure. Now the latest one that made that's on Steam, and I think they just released on consoles. It's more like the old Gauntlet games, but with modern twists
like
to it.
Top-down sort of.
Yeah. They're a lot of fun.
On NES was my first experience with Gauntlet. Yeah, like, I'd never even played an actual Gauntlet cabinet until Southern Fried last year.
Someone had one there last year. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
But yeah, I think it was malfunctioning the second day, but it was the first or second day, because it was over beside like Space Ace and Dragon Lair 2.
They had those there. Nice.
Yeah, neither one were working. Dragon's Lair 2, they said worked the first day, and it had the little sick arcade sticker on it the rest of the weekend. And Space Ace had the same problem.
Yeah. Yeah, those are tough.
The laser disc.
I mean, that's another case where we are willing to use a modern board to help us out there, because we run the original hardware in terms of the PCB and the ROM set. But a guy has just very recently released a board that it's called Dexter, and it's basically a LaserDisc emulator on a board. So it has the inputs, the data cable input on it for the LaserDisc, and then it has the video output and everything. It has a little USB port where you can just put a thumb drive that has all the video files on it, and it will take the commands from the game that tell it to jump to this part of the disc and, you know, whatever, and just play that and just act like it's a LaserDisc player. The game doesn't know any different, but it's all solid-state electronics and you know, modern, you know, surface level and stuff. And so it's surface mount stuff. And so it's going to be, you know, we think that that'll be super reliable. And that's a game where you really need it. I mean, those players, you know, can give you a lot of problems. We have the discs. We have the players. They actually work, but I just know that, you know, in terms of, it's one thing to have it in your collection in your garage or your basement or whatever, and you fire it up, you know, on Saturdays for like an hour or two, and then that's it, and it's off the rest of the time.
When it's on,
but on every day for 12 hours, that's not going to last.
No, it's not.
You know, so yeah, but I love those games though.
Yeah, the LaserDisc stuff's pretty. Dragon's Lair might be a. Utter a few words before I have to stay away from it. But
that was one of the first 50 cent games, and I, you know, which I was, you know, again, I was kind of the poor kid in the arcade, so I was like, man, you know, 50 cents, that's, I only walked in here with like 6 quarters, you know, so to spend 2 of them on, you know, this one game, and then I'm not good at it, so I'm going to die fast, but I love the game, so I would still play it some, but you know, I just couldn't ever spend much on it. But
that's one you got to have that 24 to get anywhere.
But, you know, you want, the cool thing, that game was so popular. If somebody was good and they were playing, they'd get to, like, different stages that you hadn't seen before. And people would start watching, and then pretty soon you'd have a crowd around them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they released an additional monitor that they could put on top. It's one of the few arcade cabinets that has a nice flat top. And so you can add a second TV up there. And, you know, the LaserDisc player can just drive that TV, too. And people can watch from way around, you know, because they were trying to crowd in. And, you know, of course, it's hard to play a game when people are all over your shoulders and stuff trying to watch you. And so we're going to try and see if we can put monitors on top of our Dragon's Lair and Space Aces. You know, not that we think there'll be big crowds around people, but just, you know, it's just part of the nostalgia and everything. And to have that up there, so.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that's about
wrapping up.
All right.
April 9th.
April 9th, grand opening. You know, if you don't do well with crowds, maybe wait a couple of days. But if you want to be part of a big crowd, come on down. Oh, and we got a message. I don't know what they're going to give away or whatever yet, but we got a message from a Nintendo of America sales rep, local guy. And he's going to try and come out for the grand opening and have like a little table and have some swag and stuff that he can give out and have some likes. You know, probably have like a Wii U set up with some games and stuff people can play. So we're going to try to support that. I don't know where we're going to put him yet, but we'll figure something out. You know, I think there'll be a lot of people who, I mean, we're about vintage, but I mean, it's Nintendo.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Of all the modern consoles,
that's still the
theirs is like that has the most, like, you know, they kind of always have a foot firmly still back into the past.
Oh yeah,
because I mean every console they release, I mean first off they're all about first party titles, right? Their own stuff, you know. They're all the Mario stuff, all the, you know, which now that's like 20 games.
Yeah.
I mean all the, you know, Paper Mario.
Luigi, they have a Mario in every genre of game.
Yeah. I mean there's fighting Mario, there's racing Mario. I mean I know they have different names, but I'm just saying, you know, you could just almost just call it like,
yeah,
whatever. Just pick, like I said, pick a genre, Mario, and or one of the characters, you know.
Yeah.
And they always tie back to their history. They're the most connected to their history, you know. And so I love that about them.
Yeah.
So yeah, we want to support them.
Yeah, I'll definitely be bringing my kids by here sometime. I know my little girl.
Yeah.
Little girl, she's finally getting into video games. She's six, and Wii U is, she's fell in love with it. She loves Mario and Princess Peach from the family.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
She's all about that. So she'll
keep
she'll
her away from
get
Call
a kick
of Duty.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Do.
Yeah.
Make sure that happens.
She'll definitely get a kick out of this stuff. Stepson would too.
But, we definitely like what y'all got going on here. It looks great.
And Thank you.
We're very excited. And we really appreciate you taking time to talk with us.
Well, yeah. I've enjoyed it. Hey, look, you know, everyone likes to talk about their new thing that they're doing, right? You know, I mean, so it, you know, anybody that's starting a new business, they love to talk about their business. So, of course, I'm excited to do that. So, you know, I enjoyed it, guys.
Well, we appreciate it.
Yeah.
We'll have this up online probably Thursday. Next week.
Okay.
We usually drop, so... check them out, Pints and Pixels on Facebook. Website's pintsandpixels.pub.
.pub, right.
Check them out on there. And as always, game over, man.
Game over.